This is the Education Gadfly Show.
I'm just having a hard time believing it's actually going to happen since it's sunny and warm.
We are taping this on Tuesday, I should admit. We have a lot of faith in our
weathermen
these days.
Yeah, and it's not always founded.
Now, here's your host, Mike Petrilli.
Hello, I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me in welcoming my co-host, a snowquester survivor, Dara Z. Handler.
Hello, reluctant survivor. I'm from Los Angeles. I don't do winter.
No, but you've lived in D.C. before. You were in D.C. public schools, so you must have lived through snow before, right?
I lived through it, and I complained through it a lot.
Yes. Well, here it is. Well, you know, hey, do you have some good snow boots at least so you can tromp through the weather? Are you prepared?
I am prepared, but I would so much rather be wearing my slippers than my snow boots.
Understood. Okay. Hey, lots going on all over the country, including in your adopted town of Los Angeles.
That's true. I'm excited to talk about it.
All right. So let's get started. Pamela, let's play Pardon the Gadfly.
After coming under fire for his description of how sequestration would impact schools, Arnie Duncan apologized for his choice of words, but emphasized that cuts are still a serious problem. Are they?
Well, I think they could be, but we're talking about states cutting district budgets and then districts deciding to cut teachers. So it's a trickle-down effect, and I understand that he's making statements for impact, but obviously I urge him, and I'm sure everyone in the administration urges him to be careful with his words.
Oh, I don't know about that. I mean, I think it was other people in the administration that were urging him to make a big deal out of this for political reasons. Look, Arnie Duncan has been a golden boy in the media now for going on 4.5 years. I think generally deserved. I like him a lot. I think he's a good man, and he's been a very good education secretary. But look, he went too far on this. He really tried to, he exaggerated the impact of these cuts. He made it sound like the sky was falling, and it's just not true. Now, it is true that there's going to be a handful of districts that are going to face the brunt of this. Districts that get a lot of impact aid money. This is money for school districts that are located on or near federal lands, Native American lands, or military bases, that sort of thing. And those are going to get hit, and they're getting hit right away. Certainly schools that serve lots of poor kids and have a low tax base and are not in very generous states, I mean, those school districts are going to feel it worse. But even there, we're talking about a percentage of a percentage, right?
Well, here's the thing. The very first thing that they teach you when you're going to be a teacher is never make an empty threat. You have to follow through or you're going to lose the respect of your students. Mm-hmm. And so if you're saying something specific, like teachers are going to be laid off, then you lose your credibility when that doesn't happen. That said, I think that there are some important points that he does need to make, or at least clarify. What's going to happen to federal funding for the free and reduced lunch program?
That's protected.
But he needs to be able to say that, because there's all of these remaining questions. I mean, I know that social services are kind of protected,
right. But
is that a social service program or is that an education program that risks cuts? It needs to be specific.
So look, but when we're talking about the federal education money, say Title I special ed, I believe it's getting something like an 8% cut. Okay, but in most districts that accounts to something like 10% of the money. So you do 8% of 10% and you get a fairly small number. So this is going to be something that's not going to hurt as much as the big state cuts did in the last recent years. I think districts can weather this. And as we've been saying forever, hey, doing more with less, it's an opportunity. Most organizations across the country have faced this, and the smart ones take the opportunity to let go of ineffective staff, to kill programs that aren't working, to rethink the way they do business. That's what our schools need to do as well. Okay, Pamela, topic number two.
On Tuesday, the citizens of Los Angeles voted in a hotly contested school board race, which attracted national attention and national dollars. School reform groups poured over $3 million into the race. Is this appropriate?
First of all, for the record, Los Angeles is my actual hometown, and D.C. is my adopted hometown.
Sorry, Dara. I don't know.
Just clearing that up for my mom.
For your mom. Yes. Good. Excellent.
And second, I am super excited to talk about this because we're talking about, yes, it's a local race, but it's a huge district where you have a lot of major players, especially the union and the mayor. And when you have $3 million coming in, compare that to the about $1 million that United Teachers of Los Angeles have spent on the race, and now you've got a real match going on.
Yeah, and the outside money, it's got to be more because, look, the teacher unions have such an advantage just in terms of being able to organize their own members and their members' friends and their members' families that, you know, they've got that kind of grassroots support. And look, there's a history in this city, right? Caprice Young, who is now, by the way, on the Fordham Institute board, once upon a time was the president of the LA School Board, was a hard-charging reformer, and the teacher unions went out and raised a bunch of money, did a bunch of organizing, and kicked her out of office. So, you know, this is not new to have a school board race be hotly contested and quite political.
But what I think is especially interesting about this is that the reform groups are not giving their money directly to the candidate. So by reform groups, we're talking about Students First, California Charter School Association, and also Mayor Bloomberg. They're not giving their money directly to the candidates. Mm. What they're doing is giving them to this organization called the Coalition for School Reform, which is actually Mayor Villaraigosa's group. Mm. So it's not a reformers versus union. What we're actually creating here in Los Angeles is a mayor versus union political match.
Yeah, that's very interesting for a mayor who was once upon a time an organizer for the teachers unions way back when. Fascinating stuff. Look, we're going to see more of this. Okay, there's no doubt that the school reform movement has decided to go all in on political, making political contributions, and somewhat in on political organizing. As long as the campaign finance laws stay the way they are, you've got plenty of billionaires out there, including Mayor Bloomberg, who's retiring from public life later this year, who want to spend a big chunk of their fortune on these sorts of causes. So this is going to happen. And look, I understand that the unions and their allies feel like this is unfair. They have had a huge advantage in terms of money and organizing forever. And I think what we're seeing is leveling the playing field. Look, we saw in November that the union still did quite well politically. Thank you. So, you know, there certainly hasn't reached some kind of tipping point where they've now have no voice. But there is a more even playing field, and it's a real fight. I think it's going to continue to go. We're going to see it happen at the state level, but now also at the local level.
But what do you say to the argument that, well, why would someone from New York have any interest or any right to contribute to the Los Angeles school board race?
Right, because we believe in First Amendment rights here in America. And look, it's the same reason why Michael Bloomberg is getting involved in races around the country on gun control, because it's an issue he cares about.
And he's dedicated very much.
And he's dedicated and he's rich. Okay, topic number three.
A Baton Rouge judge struck down Governor Bobby Jindal's signature education reform package earlier this week. What will this mean?
Well, first of all, it means that we got to give our former Education Gadfly Show colleague, Stafford Palmieri, a hard time. Stafford, who, as longtime listeners know, used to work at Fordham. She is now Bobby Jindal's policy director. And this was a big blow, but not really too surprising. They saw this coming. The problem was it was a technicality, right? They bundled too much stuff into one omnibus piece of legislation, and this judge is saying you can't do that.
Right. So what also got struck down as a result are a few provisions that seem to make sense, like principals and superintendents having higher fire authority instead of school boards, some reforms to tenure. All that stuff went out the window because they said it was unconstitutional that they bundled all these things together.
So my question is whether, you would think in Louisiana, where there's still, I think, a strong Republican majority, I don't know if it's a supermajority, but a strong Republican majority, that they should be able to go back and do these reforms the regular way, piece by piece, and get them through, at least if they can't get the Supreme Court down there to reverse this, right? I mean, what's wrong with that strategy?
Well, hindsight is 20/20, and I think that when you have these pieces, these bills broken apart into pieces, it gives more opportunity for outside interference and for the bills to be diluted. And so they found this a lot when they're talking about teacher evaluations, where if teacher evaluations are bundled in with a larger bill, like a budget bill or a large education bill, it's less opportunity for outside groups to kind of, especially teacher union or teacher interest groups, to come in and water the bills down. So that might be a motivating factor.
Yeah. All right. Well, we're going to watch this. Look, we generally liked a lot of what was in that policy down in Louisiana, though, as many people know, I'm not as excited about the various teacher evaluation reforms, including that one down there. But look, the school choice program, I mean, this is this is now basically through the courts, they have worked to try to put a halt to most of Jindal's reforms. And they're good reforms, and let's see. Hopefully they'll come back in a different form unless they get the Supreme Court to just say, hey, full speed ahead.
Well, they are on appeal, so we'll see.
All right. That is all the time we've got for Pardon the Gadfly. It is now time for everyone's favorite Amber's Research Minute. So, Amber, you dealing okay with Snowquester?
I think so. I'm just having a hard time believing it's actually going to happen since it's sunny and warm.
We are taping this on Tuesday. I should admit the Snowquester is supposed to hit on Wednesday in D.C. I was supposed to be in Missouri testifying on the Common Core. My flight got canceled already, preemptively. Love it. Well, hey, we have a lot of faith in our weathermen these days.
Yeah, and it's not always founded.
Hey, look, it has gotten better. Let's admit.
Yeah, it's all right, better.
Computers help a lot.
Nobody believed the sequester was going to happen either. So,
good point. Good point. They are calling our bluff. Good.
Yeah,
Congress and Mother Nature. Okay. Amber, I understand you have a juicy one for us this week.
Ooh, and I speed read it in 10 minutes. So anyway, be easy on me. New NBER study called Does Sorting Students Improve Scores? An analysis of class composition by analysts at Texas A&M and Rhodes College. So they ask a question that others have asked, which is whether or not sorting students by ability or other observable characteristics impacts test scores in math and reading. Mm-hmm. They use student-level data linked to classrooms for two school years, 03-04 and 04-05, for the Dallas Independent School District, following third-grade students who become fourth-grade students in those 2 years, mm-hmm. for a total of roughly 9,000 kids from 135 different schools in Dallas.
So when we are saying sorting, we mean basically ability grouping.
Ability and a couple other observables.
Okay, but they're taking gifted. Some kids in one classroom, different depending on prior achievement, putting
That's
them
right.
in different classrooms.
That's
okay,
right.
but
right.
it's at just, the elementary school level.
At the elementary school level, I mean, it's fairly complicated, the analysis, because you've got to sort of attempt to account for all these various unobservable things mm-hmm. that also may be occurring, like student behavior, which isn't really measured.
Right.
But I won't go into all those complications.
Okay.
Just keep in mind it's complicated and it's a limited scope. Right?
Yes.
I mean, I just told you that.
Yes.
So, all right. So be humble.
Okay.
Is what I'm saying. They found that 3/4 of students sort at least along one dimension. Roughly 19% sort by a prior math score.
So three quarters of the school's sort.
Of the school's sort.
Yes. Okay.
Along some dimension. 19% prior math, 24% prior reading, 28% appear to sort by gifted status, 57% by LEP status, 13% by SPED status. And around 40%, they say, sort it by at least two of these dimensions. Okay, roughly 1/4 of the schools have no statistically significant differences in all these various variables they studied, but that doesn't mean that they're not strategically sorting, because that may actually be a sorting that they are purposely allocating mm-hmm. these different students of differing abilities equally among these classes.
Right. But they're trying to create heterogeneous groups in that place.
Right.
Right.
Analysts also find that on average, students benefit via math gains by being placed in a more homogeneous classroom compared to a classroom with more dispersion in test scores. Impacts are similar but not as pronounced in reading. When examining student ability, analysts find that both high and low performing students benefit from more homogeneous classes. It is not the case that sorting causes high ability kids to gain at the cost of low achievers, say our analysts. They suggest that homogeneous classes allow teachers to teach to a more narrow range of students, which is beneficial for both the high and low performers. They suggest that schools should consider creating classes with less school dispersion. I'll add that the other outcomes, you know, here, put my teacher hat on. There are other outcomes other than test scores that should be considered when you are going to create homogeneous classrooms, such as classroom culture, but those were not the focus of this study.
I love it. I love it. I love it. I love it. It is in line with what we've been arguing for many years here at Fordham, which is that we should not be so afraid about ability grouping.
Mm-hmm.
And there has been this war on tracking and ability grouping, this ideological war since the, late 80s, thanks to folks like Jeannie Oakes and her allies, saying that it is always wrong to sort kids in this way. And there's been this debate that maybe there's a trade-off, that having kids all together helps the low achievers but hurts mm-hmm. the high achievers and vice versa. Interesting study showing that perhaps actually it's a win-win for these kids to be sorted in this way, at least for reading and math. You can right. bring them all together for social studies and art, music, and science mm-hmm. and all the rest, okay? Mm-hmm. But for some of these subjects, hey, if you're a teacher, how else do you handle this if you've got kids all over the spectrum?
It's easier. I will say that. It's easier, but it doesn't always feel good. I can say, I mean, I used to teach low level kids. I had like classes of low level and high level kids. Mm-hmm. And just that's why I brought up the culture thing at the end, because some of that classroom culture in that low performing class can mm-hmm. be really denigrating sometimes with some of those way those kids kind of rub off on each other.
Right.
So there's that.
Yep.
I've taught both. I've taught classes of remedial algebra, and mm-hmm. I've taught incredibly mixed classes where the lowest performing students couldn't take a percentage and the highest performing students were doing complex algebra. Mm-hmm. Both are equally challenging. I think that if nothing else, it is critical to provide adequate training to the teachers, mm-hmm. especially those in the lower performing classes, to make sure that they're not automatically teaching to the lowest common denominator, because that's what's going to drag all the students down.
No, I agree, but it doesn't seem to be happening, at least in this study. You know, I also wonder, when I've gone in with my book, The Diverse Schools Dilemma, available at Amazon, right now, or you could download it on your Kindle, right now.
Onward,
Mike. Sorry, I get distracted. You know, to talk about, schools will say, well, we want all the kids together and we're going to differentiate instruction. Well, what that actually looks like in the schools I've been visiting is ability grouping.
That's right.
I mean, it's just within the classroom, they end up having these small reading groups or these small math groups, and they are done by prior achievement levels. So mm-hmm. I think there is a lot of grouping going on, and you know, call it what you want to call it. We should not be afraid of it. You've got to group kids together for part of the day if you want to be able to target instruction. And, you know, online learning, the blended learning is another possible solution here for individual attention.
And flexible grouping, right? It's why we say just the kids aren't stuck there forever. They actually can move up.
Yes.
So sometimes that gets forgotten in real schools.
And ditching the dunce caps. I mean, that's probably just generally, you know, in this day and age, not something you want to do.
Yeah. And all the new teachers don't get the low-level kids. That would be a nice thing to change,
that
too.
That would be another good thing as well. All right, very interesting. We love it. We always love these NBER studies.
Yes, we do.
Keep them coming. All right, guys, thanks for joining. Great show. Until next week.
I'm Darcy Handelar.
And I'm Mike Petrilli at the Thomas B. Fordham Institute's Education Gadfly Show, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.